to change 15 stories. Over a period of less than 5 years, they have had almost 50 articles naming me in a negative way, which is like a vendetta. And I just decided this has got to stop. It's the Labour Party that has done this to me, because by kicking me out on totally false grounds, huge miscarriage of justice, in April 2018, they made it open season.
The judge in the British High Court described accuracy and truth as fundamental tenets of journalism and explained that the allegations made by the Jewish Chronicle with regards to Mark Wadsworth fell short of both. The lies told by the Chronicle were one of many by British tabloid press, but Wadsworth hopes his legal victory will act as a deterrent for those that seek to smear him in the future. Ahmed Cabello, London.
Let the bodies pile on high in their thousands. A sentence seared into the memories of Britons, allegedly uttered by the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson as he reluctantly approved the second England-wide lockdown late last year. Faced with fury from relatives of the bereaved, Johnson and his senior ministers emphatically denied the allegation. The man who made that claim, his former top aide turned nemesis Dominic Cummings, back with more.
This is terrible, but the people who are dying are essentially all over 80. And we can't kill the economy just because of people dying over 80.
Speaking to the British public broadcaster, he also questioned his former boss's fitness for his role and rebuked the government's pandemic performance. Just like that time, the government denies the allegations, saying the Prime Minister has taken the necessary action to protect lives and livelihoods, guided by the best scientific advice. But the numbers speak otherwise. England had one of the worst per capita deaths among the world's major economies last year, blamed by many on lockdown dithering by the government.
It was even more than that. It was an ideological predisposition towards laissez-faire capitalism and not caring about the fate of the poor. And that's deeply entrenched. They thought, let it spread through the population. Yes, the old will die, but they could use that crisis actually to generate pressure to further pursue the policies they're pursuing anyway, which are not protecting the NHS.
The new allegations come only days after number 10 made England the first country to lift almost all COVID-related restrictions, despite the rising number of cases, mostly of the Delta variant.
If you look at this Tory cabinet, they look like people who are totally unfitted for office because they simply don't care about the lives and quality of lives of the vast majority of the working people of Britain. That's not their remit. They are there to protect big business. They've shown that time and again. The fact of Cummings and Johnson falling out is just once again shedding light on what they would really like to bury, and no doubt they will try and bury when they're forced to have a COVID inquiry.
A public inquiry into the government's pandemic response is yet to happen, and it remains to be seen if these latest revelations from the Prime Minister's former advisor will seriously puncture his opinion poll rates or lead to pressure from members of his own party for him to step down. Saeed Bourizam, London.
For thousands of years, the Nile River has meant life to people in a largely arid region. But today, the river is associated with an endless dispute. Ethiopia said on Monday that it had attained its second-year target for filling a mega-dam on the Blue Nile, the Nile River's main tributary. The country said the plant may start generating power in the next few months.
We are now putting the turbines of what we call Unit 10. As soon as some important works are completed in a few months, it's all about connecting it to the transformers. And this will provide the biggest outcome of this work for the people of Ethiopia, which is generating electric power.
The project, called the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, has been at the center of a regional dispute since Ethiopia broke ground on the project in 2011. Egypt, a dry land home to nearly 100 million people, depends on the Nile for 97% of its water supply. And Sudan views the dam as a threat to its own dams and water stations, but Ethiopia deems the project essential for its development. A decade of negotiations under the auspices of the African Union has failed to result in a deal on the dam's filling and operations. The UN Security Council met earlier this month to discuss the project, but Ethiopia later slammed the session as an unhelpful distraction from the AU-led process. Experts say foreign powers' intervention throughout the years has only aggravated tensions in the region and that an African approach to the problem is needed.
I think the problem is the intervention of the imperialist countries, particularly the United States at this stage. So what has to happen is a more pan-African approach to this problem. Sudan and Egypt should sit down with Ethiopia and negotiate a policy which will benefit all three countries.
Once completed, the $4 billion project will produce more than 5,000 megawatts of electricity, doubling Ethiopia's power output. This is significant for an economy that frequently faces electricity shortages and is sometimes hobbled by power rationing. But Egypt considers the dam as a threat to its existence, and Sudan has warned that millions of lives will be at great risk if Ethiopia unilaterally fills the dam. Is a war between Egypt, Sudan, and Ethiopia brewing on the Nile? The next few months might show if tensions explode into yet another hot conflict in the war-stricken continent.
The cleanup operation continues in Belgium and Germany, the countries worst affected by last week's devastating floods following torrential rainfall. Senior figures from the European Commission have just attended a meeting of EU environment ministers.
50 degrees northwest Canada, 40 degrees in Siberia, 40 degrees in Central Europe, the floods you've mentioned, droughts agriculture is dealing with, wildfires.
Last week, the European Commission unveiled plans to cut greenhouse gas emissions in the 27-nation bloc by 55% over the next 9 years. The Commission claims it's a matter of life and death.
The infernos and hurricanes we have seen over the last few weeks are only a very small window into what our future could look like.
Environmentalists point to what's happening right now. Raging wildfires in parts of the United States and Canada, severe flooding in regions of China, crippling droughts in areas of Iran, recent tornadoes in the Czech Republic. In order to save the planet, campaigners insist the EU must cooperate with big powers like Russia, China and Iran instead of pushing them away.
Official data shows transport accounts for 29% of pollution in the EU, but one large ship generates as much carbon dioxide per day as 80,000 cars. Of course, the aviation industry is another major player, and so too is agriculture. Experts say the key is to cut our energy consumption and be more efficient.
Therefore, what energy a country uses, what sources, what does it burn? Does it burn coal? Does it burn gas, which has half the emissions of coal? Or does it do renewables, carbon-free sources? This is tremendously important for climate change.
Environmental groups say the EU needs to move faster and claims the bloc's goals are simply not ambitious enough. They are demanding that leaders agree on decisive action when they meet at a major UN climate change conference scheduled for October in Glasgow, Scotland. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Iranian documentary film Life Among War Flags, which focuses on Afghanistan and the Taliban, directed by Mohsen Islamzadeh and produced by Press TV, has been unveiled in Tehran in the presence of the filmmakers. The documentary movie Life Among War Flags narrates a different story of conflicts between armed groups in Afghanistan. Moreover, it has made research on the role of the Afghan government in such conflicts.
I have been making documentaries for about 17 years now. The Life Among War Flags depicts the story of people whose region is controlled sometimes by the Taliban, sometimes by Daesh, and sometimes by a central Afghan government and the US forces. I believe they are the main victims of the war in Afghanistan. making this documentary film was very difficult because we had to risk our lives when we went among Taliban forces. We even took part in several Taliban operations to make this documentary film.
One of the special features about this documentary is that they have shown the inner side of the Taliban, which is very dangerous and difficult. Making such a documentary will definitely raise public awareness about the real nature of such groups, which is of course so risky for the filmmakers.
The production of this documentary took 19 months to complete. The documentary's director says it has unveiled a big secret called Taliban and clearly has responded to questions which have for long been formed in the minds of international audiences regarding the nature of the militant group. The documentary film Life Among War Flags takes a deeper look at the lives of Afghan people who have tolerated years of war and bloodshed under different names and have learned to show flexibility to survive. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Poland's Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki and the EU's executive arm, the European Commission, are on a collision course. The Commission is demanding that Warsaw adheres to a recent EU Court of Justice ruling that Poland's disciplinary procedure for judges violates EU law.
We will ask for financial sanctions if Poland does not remedy the situation by the 16th of August. Let me repeat that we have said many times, EU law has primacy over national law.
The Commission has just published its 2021 EU Rule of Law report. It highlights concerns surrounding justice systems and corruption. The Commission says it's examining allegations that EU member Hungary has used spyware to hack into the phones of those criticizing Viktor Orban's government.
We will use all the possible tools to receive more information on this. So, of course, at the internal level with the different services of the Commission, we are starting, you mentioned, investigations. We are starting to collect information.
Other EU countries criticized in the rule of law report include Bulgaria, Croatia, and Slovenia. Recently, Slovenian Prime Minister Janez Janša participated in the annual conference of the MKO terrorist organization, sometimes referred to as the MEK. The terrorist group wants to oust the democratically elected government in Iran. Via Skype, former Portuguese MEP Ana Gomes says that the group is mainly funded by Saudi Arabia and Israel.
MEK pays people to participate in their events. So my question is, how much has Prime Minister Janša been paid by MEK?
Critics say the EU is quick to apply sanctions on foreign nations over alleged rule of law breaches, but is very slow to take action when some of its own 27 member states flout basic standards. The Commission's annual rule of law report repeatedly highlights the importance of media freedom. It's ironic because the EU's closest ally, the United States, continues to block .com media outlets operated from Iran, including PressTV.com. However, people can still log on using PressTV.ir. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
There seems to be no end in sight to the tensions between the United States and China. In the latest development, the US and some of its Western allies, including the UK, have publicly accused actors affiliated with the Chinese government of hacking Microsoft Exchange, an email platform used by corporations. That has escalated the already tense relations between Washington and Beijing, with the Chinese Foreign Ministry slamming that's called fabricated allegation.
The U.S. has mustered its allies to carry out unreasonable criticism against China on the issue of cybersecurity. This move is fabricated out of nothing, confuses right and wrong, and is an act of smearing and oppression that's wholly motivated by political purposes. China will never accept.
For years, the U.S. and China have been at loggerheads over issues ranging from trade, Hong Kong and Taiwan, to the South China Sea. Last week, China was infuriated further after the U.S. administration warned American companies and investors about the increasing risk of operating in Hong Kong. Washington claimed that those companies face multiple threats, including the Chinese government's ability to gain access to data foreign firms store there. the South China Sea is yet another bone of contention, with the U.S. routinely sending its warships, citing its right to freedom of navigation. The U.S. has no claim over the strategic waters, but it misses no chance to play with the sentiment of other countries having maritime stake over there. The U.K., a major U.S. ally, is also not far behind. London has now announced it would permanently deploy two warships to Asian waters. That despite China's constant warning to the U.S. and its allies over their military activities in the region. It seems the U.S. and its allies are concerned about China's growing influence around the globe. That was visible in a recent G7 meeting where the leaders of seven wealthy nations agreed to counter China's economic and security influences. U.S. President Joe Biden even urged European and Japanese leaders to offer hundreds of billions in loans to developing countries in a direct challenge to Belt and Road Initiative, which is China's global infrastructure development strategy. Beijing's relations with Washington reached to the lowest ebb during the administration of President Donald Trump, who waged a tariff war on it. China had hoped for an improvement in relations under Trump's successor Joe Biden, but he has shown no sign of discontinuing on his predecessor's hardline policies toward China. That has helped bring the Asian powerhouse closer to Russia, with both forming an invisible alliance. Biden will probably face a nightmare scenario given deepening ties and strategic cooperation between China and Russia, the countries Washington sees as a threat to its global hegemony.
The village of Vaux-sur-Chevremont on the outskirts of Liège has been devastated. Seven people lost their lives in last week's floods here. Hundreds have been forced to flee their homes.
When the water comes, I see it in my foot. I say, well, okay, we go home. But the water not in my foot come here, and I don't know what to say.
Meteorologists claim 2 months' rain fell here in just 2 days. It's being described as the worst natural disaster for eastern Belgium and western Germany in living memory. However, how natural is it? Climate change is being blamed. Also, there is criticism surrounding planning. Many towns and villages in Europe were constructed on floodplains. Some residents have been told it could be up to 8 months before their homes will be habitable again.
We lost our fridge. We don't even know where he is. He disappeared in the river. Everything is damaged. We have to do everything again.
There was also severe flooding in Netherlands, France and Luxembourg, but there's no doubt Germany and Belgium were hit hardest.
Many thousands of homes that were not destroyed are still without electricity, water and gas supplies. It might take weeks before those are restored. Aside from the tragic loss of life, the floods have caused billions of euro worth of damage.
Serious questions surround the effectiveness of the EU's flood warning system. Reviews will now be conducted to find out if all this human suffering could have been avoided.
When we get out of the house was the worst moment, because we have the feeling that we have lost everything and left it there and don't save anything.
The European Commission says it stands ready to provide whatever assistance is required. Throughout Tuesday, flags will be flown at half-mast in Belgium as the country observes a national day of mourning. Jerome Hughes in the village of Vaux-sur-Chevremont, Belgium.
The morning of Eid al-Adha, Yemenis from all walks of life came together in front of the United Nations office in Yemen's capital Sana'a to call on the international community to redouble efforts to pressure Saudi Arabia into lifting the blockade imposed on the country.
We are here for the sixth Eid, demonstrating in front of the United Nations office in Sana'a. The international body has not fulfilled its duty towards the Yemeni people. More than 6 years have passed and we have been subjected to an absurd war that killed thousands of Yemenis. We demand the international community to lift the siege imposed on the Yemeni people and release the oil ships that have already obtained entry permits by the United Nations.
Protesters blasted the United Nations for remaining silent toward the Saudi suffocating siege on Yemen. They called on the international community to take real measures to stop the Saudi piracy against Yemeni oil ships.
We are still protesting in front of the United Nations office, especially on religious occasions, in order to expose to the world the complicity between the United Nations and the Saudi-led coalition, including piracy against Yemeni oil ships despite obtaining UN permits.
Since June 2020, Yemenis have been suffering from a harsh shortage of fuel due to the continued illegal seizure of Yemeni oil vessels by Saudi Arabia. The fuel crisis has heavily affected the health sector and left the war torn country in a desperate struggle to survive.
After 6 years of war and blockade, Yemenis say the United Nations has not yet done anything to stop Saudi actions against their country. They accuse the international body of providing political cover for Riyadh's violations of international law. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
A scientist advising the British government has accused ministers of allowing infections to rip through the younger population in an effort to bolster levels of immunity before the NHS faces winter pressures. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalists Ian Sample and Heather Stewart. The piece is titled Sage Advisor Claims Ministers Trying to Get As Many As Possible Infected with COVID. Scientists advising the British government has accused ministers of allowing infections to rip through the younger population in an effort to bolster levels of immunity before the National Health Service faces winter pressures. The allegation comes after England's remaining COVID restrictions were eased on Monday, 19th of July, with nightclubs throwing open their doors for the first time in the pandemic and all rules on social distancing and wearing face masks dropped even as infections run high. Ministers were made aware of scientists' concerns about reopening nightclubs and other crowded, close contact and poorly ventilated venues without testing or other checks in place. On Monday, 19th of July, Boris Johnson made the surprise announcement that COVID passports will be required for such settings, but not until the end of September, in 2 months' time. What we are seeing is a decision by the government to get as many people infected as possible as quickly as possible, while using rhetoric about caution as a way of putting the blame on the public for the consequences, said Professor Robert West, a health psychologist at University College London, who participates in SAGE's behavioral science subgroup. It looks like the government judges that the damage to health and healthcare services will be worth the political capital it will gain from this approach, Professor Robert West said, adding that ministers appear to believe the strategy is now sustainable, unlike last year, because of the vaccine rollout. A large wave of infections coupled with mass vaccination would push the United Kingdom closer to herd immunity, where enough people in the population are resistant to the coronavirus that it no longer spreads. The threshold for herd immunity with the Delta variant of the coronavirus is unclear, but scientists estimate that the transmission would need to be blocked in about 85% of the population. Ministers have repeatedly denied that achieving herd immunity by letting cases rise is the government's goal. Last Monday's easing of restrictions, moved social distancing, the work-from-home order and legal requirements around wearing face masks through ministers, though ministers called on the public to remain cautious. The move prompted a flurry of regional mandates to maintain face masks on public transport, including on the London Underground buses and trains and Manchester Metrolink trams. Legal limits on mixing indoors lifted at the same time, allowing all businesses to reopen. The change in rules led some clubs to open at midnight on Sunday, 18th of July, leading to packed dance floors across England. Similar scenes in the Netherlands in recent weeks led the Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte to reimpose curbs on restaurants and nightclubs as new cases rose sevenfold. Meanwhile, the Shadow Health Secretary, John Ashworth, said abandoning all precaution and allowing infections to climb not only risks further restrictions in the future, it condemns thousands to long-term illness and places huge pressure on the National Health Service. Rising COVID admissions are helping exacerbate a summer NHS crisis, with operations cancelled and increasing waiting times. It means we're heading into another difficult winter, and high levels of coronavirus circulating could see a vaccine-evading variant emerge. This is an utterly reckless strategy from Boris Johnson. Data from the Office for National Statistics show that the coronavirus in England is now largely an infection among young adults. Cases in the 11 to 16-year-olds are nearly four times more common, and in 16 to 24-year-olds nearly six times more common than in 50 to 69-year-olds. While generally at low risk from the disease, young people can still develop long COVID and help fuel the epidemic, which drives up cases in those who are more vulnerable. Professor John Drury, a social psychologist at the University of Sussex, is concerned about the changes that came into force on Monday, 19th of July, such as dropping the mandate on wearing face masks, which sent a very strong signal that the COVID crisis is now less serious. Speaking in a personal capacity, Professor John Drury, who participates in meetings of the SAGE Behavioral Science Subgroup, said recent research showed that people use government policy to make judgments on risk and how to behave. The overall message is that the actions by the public, not only wearing face masks but also distancing and avoiding crowded places, are no longer required. This has already affected public behavior, he said, though those ditching COVID precautions appear to be a large minority rather than the majority. Fortunately, many people are aware of the rocketing infection rates and the risk posed to many people in society, including the most vulnerable, and are continuing to wear face masks and keep their distance out of solidarity as much as self-protection. A government spokesperson said, herd immunity has never been part of our pandemic strategy, Our approach has always been to protect the National Health Service and social care, save lives, and ensure as many people as possible are vaccinated as we learn to live with COVID-19. While the vaccination program has substantially weakened the link between infection and serious illness or death, we have been clear about the need to exercise personal caution as we ease restrictions. We are encouraging settings to make use of the National Health Service COVID Pass by requiring either proof of full vaccination or a negative test, and we reserve the right to mandate certification if necessary to reduce transmission.
Africa Today.
The COVID-19 pandemic has exposed how Africa lacks capabilities and capacity to manufacture its own pharmaceutical products, including vaccines. Leaders in the continent are now racing against time to ensure the continent manufactures its own pharmaceuticals. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa recently said his country will be hosting a technology transfer hub for coronavirus vaccines in the first step towards Africa producing its own vaccines in the future. He said this move is critical for Africa's self-determination.
The ability to manufacture vaccines, medicines, and other health-related commodities will help put Africa on a path to self-determination. This will enhance our capacity to take responsibility for the health of our people.
Hello, and a warm welcome to another edition of Africa Today, a program which gives you an incisive analysis on events making headlines in Africa. This week, we are focusing on Africa's efforts to attain self-sufficiency in the production of pharmaceuticals amid severe shortages of medicine and vaccines during the current COVID-19 pandemic. Like any crisis, the COVID-19 pandemic could present an opportunity to lay the groundwork for a better future. Will African countries rise to the occasion? Join us till the end of our show as we analyze Africa's quest to manufacture its own pharmaceutical products.
Africa's own pharmaceuticals. The COVID-19 pandemic has exposed gaps in health services that require urgent attention in many African countries. In most of the sub-Saharan Africa, pharmaceutical imports comprise as much as 70 to 90% of pharmaceuticals and medical consumables, and that is not sustainable. The few African countries with relatively developed pharmaceutical industries include South Africa, Kenya, Morocco, and Egypt. During the current pandemic, many rich countries have been stockpiling vaccines and other medical supplies for their citizens. These rich countries are way ahead in vaccinating the vast majority of their population, while even the most vulnerable in poor countries haven't gotten a single shot. This is a clear case of vaccine nationalism and apartheid. The World Health Organization Director General once again recently condemned vaccine nationalism.
Vaccine nationalism, where a handful of nations have taken the lion's share, is morally indefensible and an ineffective public health strategy against a respiratory virus that's mutating quickly and becoming increasingly effective at moving from human to human. Variants are currently winning the race against vaccines because of inequitable vaccine production and distribution. which also threatens the global economic recovery.
The dependence on imports has left most Africans vulnerable to shortages of medication and vaccines, a problem that has triggered a continent-wide crisis during the pandemic. Stakeholders in Africa are now taking action to tackle this problem. Akinwumi Adesina, the president of the African Development Bank Group, recently addressed a meeting dubbed Building Africa's Healthcare Defense System, where self-reliance in pharmaceuticals was one of the issues in focus. Let's take a listen.
The lives of 1.2 billion people in Africa are at risk. Africa, therefore, urgently needs a healthcare defense system. Building Africa's healthcare defense system can be achieved by giving priority to three critical areas. First, look at production of vaccines on the continent. Second, developing Africa's pharmaceutical manufacturing capacity. Third, building quality healthcare infrastructure.
For more on Africa's pursuit for a homegrown pharmaceutical industry, we have contacted Linda Msarira, the president of Zimbabwe's Labour Economists and African Democrats, a Pan-African political party. Thank you for joining us. We also have Julius Mbaluto, a journalist and African affairs analyst. Thank you too for your time, Mr. Mbaluto. Now, let's start off with Msarira. How has the reliance on imported pharmaceuticals affected African countries during this COVID-19 pandemic?
We need to realize that over-relying on imported stuff will affect Africa. It will affect us tremendously because we're now getting at this time where every country in the world wants to get vaccination for their people. And as long as Africa is not organized and still waiting to be receiving donated vaccinations, Africa is going to be in trouble. And we're going to lose a lot of people in Africa because of our lack of planning and programming and waiting for donations. I actually implore most African countries and African leaders to ensure that they have their own vaccination budgets in place to ensure that they'll be able to deliver the vaccination to their people timeously.
Speaking during the Building Africa's Healthcare Defense System, the World Health Organization's Regional Director for Africa said COVID-19 has been a reality check for Africa, which hinged its hope largely on global solidarity. She also briefly highlighted on the state of the pharmaceutical industry in Africa.
First of all, it's a very painful realization that Africa is a prime market for fake medicines with serious and often disastrous impacts on health. And then also to note that 99% of the vaccines and 70% of pharmaceuticals are imported to African countries. During the pandemic, we pinned our hopes on global solidarity and are right now being hit with a huge reality check brought home dramatically in the example of access to COVID-19 vaccines. And this has highlighted the need for self-reliance.
Now, Mr. Mbaluto, how has the delay in delivery of much-needed medicine and vaccines impacted on the lives of people in Africa?
What that delay has done is it just meant that a lot of people in Africa have lost their lives, have lost their loved ones. And even as we speak, some are still going through those challenges. So that reliance has not been great. And also, the idea that Africa wasn't able to produce their own medication also, it means also there's a big, big problem in terms of the global order. The problem is, you know, all these countries are interconnected. We are living in global villages, they call it. One thing happening in one country will always have a way of affecting others. So ignoring Africa or thinking about Africa as a last resort.
Mr. Mbaluto, you have said there that reliance on others for vaccines is a wake-up call. Now, can we say that the COVID-19 pandemic is a cloud with a silver lining that will eventually enable African countries to be self-reliant in the pharmaceutical industry?
There are so many lessons that COVID-19 has forced Africans to learn. And lesson number one, we have to have solutions to problems locally. We have to look for solutions also in Africa itself. When it comes to pandemics, we have to have that capacity to produce medicine to be consumed within the African continent. We have to also be able to appreciate the expertise of doctors in Africa and scientists These are lessons that COVID has really forced African countries to learn. And also, the thinking in the future should be like, yeah, Africa has to produce its own medication. Africa has to rely on itself.
Now, this disparity in the supply of COVID-19 vaccines is causing anger among many African politicians. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni says the current situation is also a wake-up call.
This unfortunate phenomenon where people have vaccines and they say, no, we must first vaccinate our own people. That's unfortunate, but I like it because it wakes you Africans. Africans are a disgrace to ourselves. Why do you have to depend on the outside for everything? Life, you depend on the outside. Why?
Now, Ms. Msarira, what's your take on efforts by African countries to manufacture their own pharmaceutical products, especially the COVID-19 vaccine, in the face of the vaccine apartheid and nationalism perpetrated by Western countries?
As long as African leaders are not promoting traditional leaders in their own countries and those who've got Western medicine qualifications to come up with vaccination programs and vaccinations for African people, I don't see any effort that will be fruitful in Africa to produce our own vaccinations. We should understand the fact that most African leaders, most African people are still drunk with the colonial systems that were left in place by the colonial masters. They believe that everything foreign is the best. They shun their own systems, and everything that is African is deemed to be evil. The Western people stole Africa's self-determination. They stole everything that is African. And it is important for us Africans, especially us, the younger generation, to start saying, how did the older generation do it? How did African people deal with such pandemics?
Thank you, Ms. Msarira. We shall now take a short break. We have much more in store for you as we analyze African efforts towards attaining self-sufficiency in the production of pharmaceutical products. Stay with us.
Africa's own pharmaceuticals.
Building more pharmaceutical manufacturing capacity in Africa would require long-term investments, but countries could offer incentives, such as cutting tariffs on raw materials. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni says what Africa needs is raw materials to produce its own COVID vaccines and not donations from the developed nations.
The raw materials for this vaccine, because of the economies of scale, sometimes it is not economic to produce every raw material, every input. It is sometimes cheaper and quicker to get some of the inputs from outside. So give us those inputs. But my people have been getting problems. It seems some people don't want Africa to stand up.
Now, Mr. Ambaluto, what are some of the stumbling blocks towards attaining self-sufficiency in Africa's pharmaceutical sector?
The willingness is there. The expertise is there. Most of these scientists and doctors who are key in the dealing with COVID-19 pandemic, most of them are from Africa as well. So the knowledge is there. The expertise is there. But the problem is the international order, because World Health Organization controls all these flows and all. And as we are speaking right now, we saw the rights to produce these particular COVID-19 pandemic jobs being given to a few companies, and also those were given the patent, which means even if in Africa they wanted to produce that, they cannot go ahead because of that world order. This world order has to change.
Ms. Ambaluto talked about the need to waive patent rights on COVID vaccines to boost global production. WTO Director General Ms. Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala has joined African countries and other developing countries in calling on global pharmaceutical giants to waive patent rights for vaccines.
We need to listen to what the developing countries who are asking for a waiver are saying. We need to dialogue with them and find ways of accommodating their concerns on intellectual property whilst also making sure we do not disincentivize research and production.
In June last year, the AU launched the African Medical Supplies Platform, which promotes the procurement of medical supplies from local manufacturers. This is expected to encourage local manufacturers and reduce reliance on imports. Addressing a virtual session during the launch, President Paul Kagame of Rwanda said it was time for African countries to stop being sorry for themselves and act.
Therefore, for Africa, move from being really very sorry for ourselves, which is the case today, and I think no one, maybe single person, takes the blame for that, but we have to overcome that and move from what we know has not worked for us, for Africa, well, to something we can do and we are able to do, given a few examples again President Ramaphosa mentioned.
Nearly six decades after independence, most African leaders are still talking about having their own pharmaceutical, but their countries still lag behind. Where is the problem here?
The tragedy of Africa is corruption. And African governments have deliberately thwarted any effort in their own countries to ensure that we have local pharmaceutical companies that thrive.
Boosting local pharmaceutical production is expected to save lives, improve public health, and strengthen African economies, including supporting local jobs. It should also trigger the sharing of crucial technologies. How will self-reliance in pharmaceutical industry contribute to the improvement of public health in African countries?
If we can see Africa, even to the level that they are producing medication, which is acceptable globally, that number one is going to improve the economies of Africa. When Africa will be in control in providing medication for its own population, which is more than 1.3 billion, that would be fantastic. And the idea that these pharmaceuticals are on the ground in Africa, production is happening, it definitely means the cost of medication will be comparatively cheaper than if it was all being sourced from the Western capitals. So it's a very important goal for all leaders in Africa. As they come to lead their nation, as anyone aspires to be a leader, think health. Think of a healthy nation first. And just ask yourself, what can that do to the economy of the country, to the wellness of the nation?
Africa has so many thousands and thousands of its medical personnel outside of Africa. Just because the infrastructure is so poor, they don't want to work here. So we need to connect them back and have financing facilities that allows us to tap our best minds in diaspora and bring them back into Africa.
Many African professionals have been forced to look for greener pastures in Western countries due to low salaries at home. Now, governments have invested heavily in training these professionals who have now been poached by developed countries. A Nigerian doctor explains here why doctors are leaving the country.
Conditions for health care professionals in this country are quite deplorable. The pay, equipment and facilities to manage, to diagnose patients and manage them effectively are generally lacking in most health institutions across the country. This in itself is enough for one after a lot of years of rigorous training to seek greener pastures elsewhere. It's not just seeking greener pastures, but the job satisfaction.
Now, Ms. Msarira, what should governments do to prevent this brain drain, which has affected the health sector in many African countries?
The biggest challenge that we have in most African countries is we've got leaders who are out of touch with realities of the real struggles that African people go through. It all goes back to the misgovernance systems that we have, the colonial systems that were adopted from the colonial era, where we have had no serious efforts to ensure that we change the systems that were left in place during the colonial systems to have systems that work, that serve the African person. It is unfortunate that most doctors or pharmacists prefer to go and work in Western countries to get better salaries. But at the end of the day, they will still have to plow back home and send a lot of money back home for their own relatives to be able to get proper health care. What we need to do as African people is to ensure that we push our governments to comply with the Abuja Declaration. We make sure that all health personnel, frontline workers in the health industry, have got decent salaries that can sustain their livelihoods and their families.
Ms. Msarira there talked about the Abuja Declaration on Health. Now, in 2001, African governments made an historic pledge to allocate at least 15% of their annual budgets to the health sector. This vow became known as the Abuja Declaration.
WHO Regional Director for Africa says countries in the continent have failed to fulfill this pledge, but has expressed optimism that the situation will change. The head of the Africa Center for Disease Control and Prevention, John Nkengasong, says Africa's ability to respond to future pandemics is dependent on how much investments governments on the continent make in health and education. Nkengasong says Africa needs to develop its workforce, improve manufacturing capacity of diagnostics, and building capacity in vaccines development and treatment.
You go to war against these viruses with three dimensions. You have to have your diagnostics, vaccines, and treatment all together. So that has to be an African-driven solution and approach for that. The third area, of course, is institutions. You fight wars with institutions, and strong public health institutions for the continent. Clearly, no doubt about that. And then thirdly, partnership with the private sector.
Mr. Mbaluto, our last question to you. What needs to be done for the pharmaceutical industry in Africa to meet the needs of the masses?
The regulation of the production of medicine has to really be reformed. It has to see professionals for who they are. It has to recognize that even in Africa, we have professionals who are as good as any other professionals. So the international regulatory mechanism for production of medication has been the challenge, because to pass any medication that has been produced, it goes a long way, takes a long time, and also it's a cash-intensive program also, because it requires a lot of money to do this, and therefore there should be reforms from the international system that are all the time entering Africa from producing its own medication.
Mr. Mbaluto there says that the international regulatory framework is inherently biased against African innovations. Thanks a lot for your time, Ms. Mbaluto, African Affairs Analyst. Now to Ms. Msarira, you have the last word. What will it take to have a vibrant pharmaceutical industry in Africa?
The biggest impediment in attaining self-reliance in pharmaceutical companies in Africa are inconsistent pharmaceutical policies, inconsistent health policies, which do not benefit the ordinary people in Africa. So what is important is for African people to start making sure that they hold their governments to account, they push for local pharmaceutical companies which can provide and deliver affordable, safe medicines to the people in Africa. It is also important for African countries to start investing in grassroots acquirement of medicines, because most of these medicines that we import, most of the raw materials actually come from Africa, but they go and get processed in other countries. But when our government, our university, starts ensuring that they put more resources into pharmaceutical companies, into production of medicine here in Africa, it will be a good idea which will be able to lift Africa out of the poverty and the health crisis that we have in most African countries.
Well, very well put there. African governments need to commit more resources for the pharmaceutical industry in the continent to compete globally. Thanks for your insight, Ms. Msarira, the President of Labour Economists and African Democrats. Our time is over for today. I'm sure you enjoyed the show. Thanks a lot. Take care and goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Khomeini guided the Iranian nation to determine their own fate, June 4, 2021. A televised speech delivered on June 4, 2021 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the 32nd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini. Greetings be upon him. Since the first day when the Islamic Republic was formed, ill-intentioned personalities, enemies, and those inside and outside the country who could not digest and tolerate that great phenomena said that the Islamic Republic would not survive more than 2 months. And sometimes they said that it would not survive more than 6 months. 1 year and thereafter that it would be overthrown. Well, Imam's power and decisiveness and subsequently the great victories of the Iranian nation in the 8-year war and various other events extinguished that uproar. In other words, the uproar gradually diminished and it was almost non-existent at the end of Imam's life. But after his demise, ill-intentioned individuals were resuscitated again and their hope was boosted again, thus repeating their cliché dreams in the form of predictions. A very old and derelict party with extravagant claims made an announcement in the year 1369 saying that the Islamic Republic was standing at the edge of a precipice. Actually, this was what the announcement meant. Subhanallah, alhamdulillah, wa la ilaha illallah. Subhanallah. In other words, if it makes one more move, it will be done for. This was said in the year 1369. A few years later, another group and another party, they unfortunately held governmental positions. They were among the members of the Islamic Parliament at that time, wrote a letter saying that there was little time left for the Islamic Republic. It implied that the Islamic Republic would not survive more than a few days and that it should be overthrown. That was another party, and they more or less had the same dispositions as the other party. It shared the same beliefs with it to some extent. Before and after those people too, there were individuals, groups and parties who used to say the same things inside or outside the country, under the aegis of foreigners and the enemies of the Islamic Republic, and their statements would be broadcast in the radio and other such media, foretelling the overthrow of the Islamic Republic. That is to say, they voiced their visual thinking in the form of news, analysis, and the like, and they shared that happy news with one another.